You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In Portrait Inside My Head, his latest collection of personal essays, Philip Lopate draws upon his experiences first as a child growing up in Brooklyn, then as a reluctant student leader in the 60s, a baseball fan, a father, and, yes, a brother, interweaving the public and the personal to highlight the often contradictory nature of memory. It's one of two books that have just been published by the Free Press. His other one, To Show and to Tell, is a nuts and bolts guide to the craft of literary nonfiction, drawing upon his 40 years of experience as a writer, teacher, and professor. I'm always happy to welcome my brother, Philip Lopate, or as he incorrectly prefers, Lopate, back to our show.
Hi. No, it's Philippe.
Philippe Lopate. Well,
my old ego.
Bonjour. What, if anything, is off limits to you when you're writing a personal essay?
There are some things that are off limits. Some of your darkest secrets, for instance.
You protecting me?
I'm protecting you. Depends on how much I'm paid to protect. but no, seriously, I think it's decided on a case-by-case basis. I'm perfectly willing to expose my own foibles, but I have to be a little bit more diplomatic when it comes to other people's.
Well, what about some of the other notable personal essayists of the past? Did they talk about this? Montaigne, Hazlitt, Lamb?
Montaigne was a great observer of his own peculiarities. And you would find out very, very small things about him and peculiar things about him. But he almost never wrote about his wife, for instance. I should add that if you write personal essays about your wife, your head may be handed to you. So,
and you have included your wife in a number of the essays.
Yes, I have, and my head has been handed to me.
So you don't pass it by, Cheryl, while you're working on the thing? Say, is this okay with you?
No, I do, and sometimes she says, no, it's not okay, and then I go ahead and publish it.
Anyway.
It depends, really. I like to please people. I like to be a good guy. But there are times when I've written something that I think is important for me to get out, and so I have to override the sentiments of those close to me.
Well, you write, it's hard to expose and hide at the same time.
Yeah. I think that I'm always trying to get at a kind of honesty. That's my goal. But Montaigne once said that he wrote X about himself so that he wouldn't have to write Y. So, you know, you have to do – I follow Janis Joplin. I have to give a piece of my heart one way or another. But which piece is the question?
Well, much of these essays are about memories, your memories of how things happen.
Yes. At a certain age, the past starts to become more and more important.
But do you ever find yourself questioning your memory when you're writing about a certain set of events?
I certainly do. We both have a sister who has a much better memory than I do. But I have a kind of writer's memory, which is things that have some affect, some emotion stick to me, and others don't. I don't remember everything.
Are there instances when you haven't wondered or cared if your memory of a topic you're writing about is flawed?
Where I haven't cared about it?
Well, this doesn't matter.
Is this a trick question, Lenny? Are you trying
no.
to? What did I get wrong?
Well, sure. In reading
Let's
these things.
Out with it. Let's hear it.
In reading these things, in any family, if there is an event that's being discussed, people have different memories of the same event. Sometimes I'm stunned by things that you've written because I had forgotten those details, and I've really been grateful to you for reminding me of some of the horrors of our youth. But in other cases, I've thought, well, gee, that's not the way I remember it, and I assume that's normal, but that's why these are personal essays?
Yes, exactly. They are personal essays. They have a real subjective element. I don't go back and research what was happening that day in 1952, but I think most of what I've written is fairly accurate. I certainly don't fabricate intentionally, and we all know that memory is subjective, that it's flawed, but having said that, we can still try to tell the truth as we see it.
Well, I don't know whether personal essays and memoir are the same thing, but often in
the personal essay is the lazy man's memoir. You know, that is, I write a section of my past, and maybe someday I will write a memoir. But essentially, it's a quick read, you might say.
Well, the reason I brought it up is whenever a memoir is discussed, the memoirists always will say, well, you know, there's a certain amount of shaping that has to be done.
Yes.
This is not autobiography. I'm remembering conversations. I'm not quoting them exactly because they weren't recorded.
Well, that's why I don't like to write long dialogues in my personal essays, because the scrupulous reader will say, how the heck did he know that, you know? So a lot of times what I'm really doing is reflecting on the past. And that I can do in good conscience. That is, I'm trying to make sense of what happened, not just to recall what happened.
And an important part of all of this is finding a voice, isn't it?
Yes, finding a voice. And I have, in my book about writing literary nonfiction, I have a whole essay on the necessity of turning yourself into a character. In order to find a voice, you have to be able to take a step back from yourself and kind of construct yourself into a persona.
So the way you say it is creating a distance between yourself and the person in the essay.
Yes, yes. I'm not exactly the person on the page. Sometimes I turn the volume up a little. Sometimes I turn it down. Sometimes I make myself more contrarian than I really am for the sake of effect or provocation, let's say.
My guest is Philip Lopate, author of over a dozen books, including three personal essay collections, Bachelorhood, Against Joie de Vivre, and Portrait of My Body. He also wrote the classic about the New York waterfront called Waterfront, and he directs the graduate nonfiction program at Columbia University. His two new books being released at the same time, a collection of essays, pretty much all of them having been printed before?
Yes.
It's called Portrait Inside My Head. And then there is a book called To Show and To Tell, The Craft of Literary Nonfiction, both of them from Free Press. To Show and To Tell, of course, the advice people always give to writers is
show, don't tell.
Yes. But you're saying that is not always the best advice?
Absolutely. I think that you needn't do everything indirectly. Sometimes you can share your thinking with the reader, and it's a good thing to do so. And one of the advantages of the essay is that it's a track of one's consciousness, and so it's the perfect arena in which to tell. If you can't tell in an essay, where can you tell?
But you've also published fiction and poetry.
That's right.
So do you live by the other rule in those?
I always like to tell. I'm a blabber. I'm a teller. There is a kind of fiction now that we're seeing more and more of that I would call essayistic fiction. And, you know, we saw it in David Foster Wallace and Sebald and Thomas Bernhardt, where the voice telling is very important. It's synthesizing. It's not all done in scenes and dialogues. And I think that's certainly true of personal essays. You don't have to just do everything in scenes and dialogues. That's like writing with one hand tied behind your back.
Now, you've written a piece about Thomas Bernhardt and why for a long time you chose not to read him despite the acclaim that he received from most of your contemporaries. And you make fun of yourself in that piece.
I sure do. I make fun of myself as a wannabe intellectual who is sensitive to the fashions, the flavor of the month, but then resists them. And I've always had a kind of, you might say, complicated relationship to the avant-garde, which is I want to know what's hip, but then I don't like the bullying aspects of a hip.
And you make fun of yourself in another essay called Howl and Me, which you write about being junior high school and high school student and encountering Allen Ginsberg's poem.
Encountering it, probably being introduced to it by you, as a matter of fact, who introduced me to a lot of poetry.
Okay, I'll
that
apologize.
No, it's a great poem. It's a great poem. I mean, I happen to prefer Kaddish, which I think is one of the greatest American poems of all time. But Powell is certainly one of the most important poems. But what I like to do, and I did this also in my book Notes on Sontag, is to interrogate my ambivalence and actually say where I go for something and where I stop.
Well, in the case of Allen Ginsberg, you knew him years later.
Yes.
Does that color the memories of reading him before you ever thought you'd ever meet him?
I liked Ginsberg actually as a man. There was something very sweet about him. It's very different to read somebody who's a dominant literary figure when you're growing up, when you're an adolescent. These people are demigods. Since then I've met Norman Mailer, I've met Philip Roth. It's a real trick of perspective, you know, that you have to. I'm sure you've met a lot of giants, you know, that you've interviewed, you know.
Some of whom I've admired as writers, but not necessarily as people, and vice versa.
I often think, don't meet your heroes, you know. It may be disillusioning.
Some of the pieces in the essay collection are your meditations about a wide range of writers, Stendhal, Charles Reznikoff, James Agee. And Leonard Michels. Different from standard literary criticism because they make no attempt to be critically objective?
No, I think that they are critical pieces. But
they're different than when you write a review, aren't they?
The Leonard Michels was written as a review. I think that what I wanted to show in this book was that it's the same process of thinking, whether you write a personal essay or whether you write about movies or books. I have a lot of different interests, and I really wanted to present what is essentially a portrait inside my head and say, well, this is all me. And so let's see the same mind working on different materials. For instance, I have a kind of analytical bent. I like to circle around something from different angles. And I do that whether I'm writing a book review, a piece about my experience, a movie review. So it's all kind of like trying to untangle a kind of process, a kind of problem.
But aren't you going against everything that your teachers taught you in high school? I remember I was always chastised if I used the word I too much in writing about something other than when I was writing fiction.
That's true. That's probably less true now than it was when we were growing up. We were basically slapped on the wrist for using the word I in critical papers. It's not so much that I use the word I as that I think that all criticism is a kind of disguised personal essay, and that what makes criticism alive is a display of personality. So somehow the personality has to leak through. And even writers like Edmund Wilson or Lionel Trilling or Susan Sontag, who often didn't use the word I, they still radiated a kind of powerful personality.
But do you think that's why sometimes readers are outraged by a review? Because it is really just a reflection of that reviewer's personality.
Yes.
But they see it as an objective thing and say, how could you say piece of junk was a great work of art, or vice versa?
Yes, exactly. Often it's vice versa. How could you not respond? I think that you have to know very well what your biases are, where you came from, and understand and try to correct for them. You know, there are some people who grew up poor who can't bear to read narratives about rich people. Some people who grew up poor can't bear to read narratives about poor people.
There was somebody once said to me, when you're reading Vincent Canby's reviews of movies, you just have to assume that no matter what Woody Allen has made, mm-hmm. Canby's going to love it. And that's just part of understanding what Vincent Canby's all about.
Exactly, because critics are human beings, and you end up correcting for their blind spots. But you still can become very attached to them, as I have to Vincent Canby or Manola Dargis and so on.
In your essay, Brooklyn, the Unknowable, you write about a national nostalgia for Brooklyn or the Brooklyn of our collective memories, and then you quickly poke holes in those illusions. What's the danger in remembering things a bit differently from the way they actually happened? Is this a slippery slope?
Well, you know, I don't you think there's something funny, Lenny, about this whole Brooklyn hoopla? I mean, as far as I'm
concerned, I think Brooklyn is the center of the world.
Because you live there, right? As do I. But I just like to I do like to be a little mocking and self-mocking because it brings a tension and a liveliness to a piece. But in terms of Brooklyn, I think that, you know, it's a kind of branding phenomenon that's going on now, you know.
You, one of the essays is Memoirs of a Wishy-Washy Left Liberal.
Yeah, I thought that would get to
your time as a president of the alumni for a new Columbia around the time of the Columbia strikes.
Yeah.
As in many of your essays, there is a tone of self-deprecation
but
throughout
also,
the piece.
Also skepticism, I think. Well, that's even more than self-deprecation, I think self-skepticism is part of it. It's like you begin to assert something, and then inside me, I really always hear a kind of glimmer of doubt, like, yeah, well, so what, you know? There's a voice inside me that second-guesses myself all the time. And one reason I'm drawn to the essay is because I think that the essay is an invitation to doubt. And you know, there are many times in life where you have to just assert very strongly, you know, if you're a lawyer, for instance. Maybe that's why I didn't become a lawyer.
Well, I think that the big issue in personal essays is why would anybody care about what happened to you and what you were thinking about those things?
I'm not a celebrity like you, Lenny, so, you know, why would somebody care?
That is really important in our relationship and our sibling rivalry, but not in this discussion.
I think
so.
That,
you have to find ways to find some kind of a universality.
Yes, it's two things. I have to assume that the experiences that I'm talking about will have some resonance with other people, some universality. The other thing is that I have to make it into, or try to make it into, a piece of literary art. That is, I have to bring stylistic sparkle to the page so that it's entertaining. And that's the reason to read it. The reason to read a writer who isn't a celebrity is just for the pleasure of style.
There is a wonderful passage in the essay, Memoirs of a Wishy-Washy Left Liberal, about you're being interviewed by someone on WBAI at a rally in the quadrangle at Columbia. And you find yourself mesmerized by a blue jay that is standing nearby.
Yes, I was supposed to pontificate and just deliver the line, and suddenly I saw this bird hopping about. And as you know, Lenny, the worst thing on radio is dead silence, you know. And suddenly I was just looking at this bird and forgetting my obligation to be a left-wing spokesman.
So did you say, oh, look at the blue jay?
No way, you know. I just conked out. The guy started sweating, and then I came to and mouthed all the cliches.
Now, have you ever wondered why you remember that detail and some probably equally important details from your past?
In that case, it was one of the details that was making me realize that I needed to continuously question my assumptions, for instance, about politics. You know, I was a good lefty marching along, and I remember very well that we were told that Pol Pot was a good guy, and the New York Times was distorting things, you know.
And Mao Zedong never killed anybody.
He never killed anybody, yeah. So then after a while, I came to the conclusion that if I wasn't there, as I say, was you there, Charlie? I was not there, and so I didn't know what I was talking about, and I better keep quiet until I got more information.
One of the longer essays in Portrait Inside My Head is The Lake of Suffering, in which you recount the story of the early health struggles of your daughter, Lily. Could you have written it in the same way if Lily hadn't overcome all the problems that she had in her preteen years?
That's a very good question. I think that I had to write about that because it was one of the most important experiences of my life. But clearly, when she got better and got all healthy, it gave me an arc, for one thing, and it gave me a calm out of which I could write. It's very hard to write when you're too agitated.
Mm. Well, you do. You mentioned earlier about the impact on your family.
Mm-hmm.
Lily mm-hmm. probably would not be upset by reading this. But you also write candidly about the effect of this experience, years and years of worrying whether Lily was going to actually survive.
Right.
The impact it had on your marriage.
Yeah.
So
I mean, I would say that any time there's a sick child in the picture, that's going to put a real strain on a marriage. And you know, it's a testimony to the fact that I have a good marriage that that we were able to surmount all that. But clearly, the fact that Lily got better was important in that.
Do you have? How do you choose what to write about? Do you have criteria for whether a certain experience is worthy of an essay?
Well, if something is very urgent, then I have to write about it. For instance, when our father was at the end of his life, basically dying, I found that I had to write a piece about him. I did not want to write a piece about him after he died, but I wanted to write it in those last months.
For what reason? To find out how you really felt about him?
No, to say goodbye, to grieve in advance, maybe. It was just pressing in on me. So sometimes I'm just thinking about something all the time, and I've got to write about it.
Do you begin thinking you're writing about one thing and then discover that your topic is actually something else?
Yes, and not only that, but often I'll begin, let's say, in a comic vein, and as I keep writing, the essay morphs in a more serious direction. So I like the idea that personal essays can have a number of tones. They can be both comic and serious, for instance. And one of the great things, and this is true of Charles Lamb or Hazlitt, they'd start an essay in one place and they'd be surprised where it would take them. It's like a ride.
And that is part of the whole process of writing a personal essay. People who write fiction will tell you the same thing. That they start off with one thing and then they discover that they're moving in a place they never expected to go.
Right. Flaubert said that if you know exactly what you're going to write, it's going to be dead on arrival. He said it more elegantly than that. But that, you know, I myself feel that when I start to write something, there got to be some answers that I don't know yet that I'm going to try to find out in the process of writing.
Is this something you can teach the book to show and to tell? Does offer advice on the craft of literary nonfiction, both for would-be writers and also for people who teach writing nonfiction. How much can you teach? Because they say that you really can't teach somebody to write fiction. You can give them, push them in the right direction, but in the end,
well, I think there's
two brilliant students in the same class. One turns out to be somebody special, and the other one turns out to be nothing.
Sure, and a lot of times it isn't brilliance alone. It's the ability to plant your buttocks on the chair and just sit there hour after hour. It's the stubbornness that counts as much as the verbal brilliance, I think. But I think you can teach some things, and there's a lot of confusion in the field of creative nonfiction now or literary nonfiction, and so. In a way, I'm just trying to give some guidelines, common sense guidelines.
Now, when you say creative or literary nonfiction, are we talking about the equivalent of the new journalism?
That's part of it, I think. And I think a lot of it came out of the new journalism.
But there was, for a long time, perhaps we didn't see as many personal essays because there was a kind of a lesser form, wasn't it? When Tom Wolfe came along, people like that, it caused great controversy.
Well, it was considered moribund, but, you know, you got to understand that the essay is like a cockroach. You know, it will survive us all. There will be times when it's despised. There will be times when it's revered. But basically, it's been around for a long time. It's not a new thing.
Although I still see essays that are the equivalent of what my high school teacher wanted from me, and it was it started off with something like sanitation is important because
you got to have that topic sentence in
and
those
then you end up with, and that's what and the last sentence is and that's why sanitation is important.
Yeah, when I taught undergraduates, they would often we restate the initial thing, and I'd say, well, I don't have Alzheimer's. Why are you telling me this again? They'd say, well, our teacher told us, our other teacher in the other class told us we had to revert, you know?
And why do you think that is? I see it sometimes in essays from very sophisticated writers.
Yeah, well, there are only so many ways to end an essay. And I have an essay in this new book, To Show and to Tell, about how do you end an essay. One of them is obviously to return to the scene of the crime. Another is to hold off one insight till the end that's completely new so that you'll give the reader pleasure at the end. You know, there are lots of ways.
Is it important to you to always reveal negative things about yourself? There's in eight pages in one of these essays, you recall how a poem you'd written called "I Hate It All" got you into hot water, and then you talk about a suicide attempt.
Yeah, well, this, I don't really understand the terms positive and negative when it comes to experience. I'm very glad I had the upbringing I had, which, as you know, was kind of hard and difficult. So after a while, all these experiences form you, and it's not like you only want to think about the nice ones, you know. Sometimes you think with more pleasure about the not nice ones.
Mm-hmm.
I also am drawn to the squeamish, you know, the thing that you don't want to think about or that I don't want to think about.
Do you think that comes out of the fact that you wrote fiction before you wrote nonfiction?
I think it has to do with
Then poetry, which was often confessional.
I think it's just a basic part of my personality, which is the cowardly part of me wants to evade and make nice, and then the courageous part says no, let's get down to it, you know. And so there's an excitement when you overcome a fear.
Philip Lopate's two new books, both from Free Press, are To Show and Tell, The Craft of Literary Nonfiction, and his collection of essays, personal essays, called Portrait Inside My Head. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Good, and I'll see you tonight.
I'll talk more about that in a moment. Yes, as Philip mentioned, Randy Cohen will be speaking with Philip and me tonight at 7 at the 92nd Street Y Tribeca. For more information, you can visit our show page. We hope to see you there. It begins at 7.